Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Native wild turkeys are thriving in Iowa, but it wasn't so long ago that they were nowhere to be found. We'll learn about these remarkable birds and their comeback story from Iowa State University Extension wildlife biologist Adam Jenke later this hour. But first, we're going to travel back in time to 1820, when an expedition comprised of 32 people, 8 mules, and 7 horses traveled from Fort Atkinson in Nebraska to what is now Minneapolis. Their goal was to find a convenient route between those two points, and spoiler alert, they did not find one, but they did find wild and beautiful land, and two of the men kept meticulous journals on what they saw and experienced, Stephen Watts Carney and Andrew Talcott. We can learn a lot from those journals, and we've asked Larry Grill, an amateur historian in Schleswig, Iowa, and Glenn Pollock, an amateur naturalist who lives in Omaha, to share what they have learned. Together, they'll be giving a presentation, Chronicles from the Trail, at Hitchcock Nature Center in Pottawatomie County on Saturday, December 7th, and they are here with me now. Hello, Larry.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And hello, Glenn.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And Larry, I'm going to start with you. Put this in historical context for us. Take us back to 1820 and tell us just a little bit about what was going on at that point.
Okay. Well, as a background, when Thomas Jefferson acquired the Louisiana Purchase, that added a tremendous amount of area to our country, and most of it was unexplored, and they didn't have any idea what was really in it. And, of course, the first expedition that they sent out was the Lewis and Clark Expedition, which covered a great deal of territory and provided a lot of information. But over the next 20 to 30 years, there was a number of other additional military excursions out into this area that tried to gather additional information about a wider variety of area and conditions that were out here. Their main purpose was to take possession and get authority over the territory and to find out just what the assets that they had acquired were out here.
All right. So, of course, we know that Lewis and Clark went on their expedition in 1804 through 1806. We also know that they didn't spend much time in Iowa. They touched Iowa just a little bit with the Corps of Discovery. So at this point in 1820, what do we know about how much time the settlers or the European settlers who were making their way into this land had spent in Iowa?
Well, there was hardly any in Iowa because at that time, Iowa was considered part of Indian territory and it was off limits to white settlement. So the only European influences were actually along the river edges on either side of the state. Through the middle of the state, the only European influences were some traveling fur traders who would deal with the Indians. There was no real settlements involved that early in our history.
In 1820, when this expedition was put together, what was the purpose of it?
Well, essentially, they were to find a military road between Fort Atkinson, which is in Nebraska, just north of Omaha, to Fort Snelling, which is now in the heart of Minneapolis. And on the way, they were to find the topography of the land, the water resources, the timber, the wild animals, the Native Americans that were here, and find out as much as they could about the area that they were covering.
All right. And we know, as I just mentioned, there were these two journals that were kept by Stephen Watts Carney and Andrew Talcott. Stephen Watts Carney's journal has been a real treasure for historians for quite some time. Larry, when did you first encounter this work?
Oh, well, I've been interested in local history for a long time. And one of the things that interested me early on was the fact that this expedition came very near my hometown here, and for a while there, it looked very much like they may have camped on our town site. Later, it looks like they didn't quite camp right here, but they came very close past us, and since it was an integral part of our local history here, I became more interested in the entire expedition that they went on.
And tell me, Glenn, when did you first get interested in this expedition?
I
I've always been interested in the natural world, especially the tallgrass prairie. And I can't remember how I stumbled upon this, but realizing that this is describing, and as Larry said, Larry and I are originally from the same area, describing my own route that I have traveled many, many, many times, and realizing in 1820. And I was trying to figure out how to describe this to people, and it just dawned on me the other day when I was watching public TV about the Serengeti. In 1820, Iowa was the Serengeti. It was untouched by humans. We had large bison herds, and we didn't have elephants and giraffes, but we had an incredible number of wildlife and native grasses and native flowers that grew to this area. And it just struck me that here's actually somebody who described an area before the white man arrived, and it just fascinated me.
Right, and I do need to point out that, of course, this was not uninhabited by humans, this land. There were many native people who traveled through and lived in Iowa and the land surrounding it. But these were among the first white settlers to reach this land and describe it and record what they had seen. How did the two of you get connected? Glenn, you want to tell us that?
We're cousins.
Okay. So did you always share an interest in history with each other?
No, we didn't discover each other till the Les Hills Prairie Seminar. Larry, I can't talk this morning, is also an avid genealogist. And I walked up to him and I says, "Grill, I think we're related." He says, "Yes, we're cousins." And there's where our friendship started. And we did the program that we're going to do in December, a modified version of it, at the Les Hills Prairie Seminar. And we decided we wanted to try to expand it a bit since we discovered a new book called The Exploration of Lieutenant Andrew Talbot, a self-published book by a gentleman in Minneapolis, and added a great amount of information to our lecture. So we're going to. So that's how we discovered each other, not knowing that we were related.
All right. So you just definitely share an interest in history as well as a few genes as well. So let me ask you, Larry, to give us an idea when this expedition set out. Now, of course, we are going to focus on the Journal of Stephen Watts Kearney, but he was not the expedition leader, right? So describe the expedition for me.
Okay. No. The person in charge was a Colonel Matthew McGee, Captain McGee. Stephen Watts Kearney at that time was also a captain, but he was going along not as a person in charge, but as a person going attached to the survey. And he was the one who gets the most credit for it because he was the one who kept the journal.
Right,
and
he wrote
and
it
his
down.
Description is what really made the expedition the most interesting.
And you have the original orders for the expedition. Can you read a little passage from that for us?
Let's see. Where did I? Okay, this is from Colonel Henry Atkinson, who is in charge of Fort Atkinson in Nebraska. And his orders were, "You are attached to this party that has been detailed for the purpose of exploring the country lying between this place and the military post at the mouth of St. Peter's River," which is actually Minnesota River, "and for marking a route over the nearest and most practical way. You are charged with surveying this route and taking a topographical sketch of the country over which it passed. In performing this duty, you will be careful in laying down the courses and noting the distances nearly as can be attained, taking latitude as often as possible to correct the knowledge of this country. You will keep a detailed field notes of the character of the country over which you pass, embracing streams and water courses, woodlands, prairies, and their situation and probable extent, and the kinds and sorts of timber, rocks, soil, minerals, and other such remarks as may be thought useful and interesting." So he had quite a wide-ranging goals to try to accomplish while they were going.
For sure. And now Stephen Watts Kearney is the one that wrote most of the things down. I mean, it sounds like everybody was supposed to be keeping notes, or was that Kearney's role?
Well, it was Kearney's role, and his was one that was most definitely noticed. Lieutenant Calcott was the science officer that was assigned to this expedition, and he was also to be keeping field notes. Now, the field notes that Calcott met were not published very widely or very widely known, whereas Kearney's were very much known. As a matter of fact, the complete copy that is most available right now is in the Annals of Iowa, which was published in 1912, or the Missouri had a version that was even earlier in 1908. But Talcott's notes were not really published until this last summer. In July of 2019, Donald Borcherding published a book where he interpreted Lieutenant Talcott's field notes and published, which it gave a little more detail to. Kearney's is more of a narrative approach to it, where Talcott was a more detailed scientific note-taking.
Okay, interesting. Well, and we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment, but also give me, before we go to the break, a little bit more of an idea of who else was on the journey. They had hired Native people to guide them, right? So who else was there?
Well, they had a Native guide, yes, and his wife and young child were also on the trip. There was a group of riflemen who were on the troop. There was a group of infantrymen on the troop, plus several other officers who were traveling along from one fort to the other fort.
Okay, well, we are going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. Glenn, I want to hear more about the land that they traveled on and the route that this expedition took in just a moment. We are talking about an expedition that set out in 1820, comprised of 32 people, 8 mules, and 7 horses, traveling from Fort Atkinson in Nebraska to what is now Minneapolis. And my guests are Larry Grill, an amateur historian from Schleswig, Iowa, and Glenn Pollock, an amateur naturalist who lives in Omaha. Together, they'll be giving the presentation Chronicles from the Trail at Hitchcock Nature Center in Pottawatomie County on Saturday, December 7th. Later this hour, we'll talk about wild turkeys. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast, Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, we're going to talk about native wild turkeys in Iowa. We have a thriving turkey population, but that wasn't the case very long ago. We'll talk about their amazing conservation comeback story and learn more about these unusual and remarkable birds with Iowa State University Extension wildlife biologist Adam Jahnke. With me now, I have Larry Grill. He's an amateur historian from Schleswig, Iowa, and Glenn Pollock, an amateur naturalist who lives in Omaha. Together, they're going to be giving a presentation called Chronicles from the Trail at Hitchcock Nature Center in Pottawatomie County on Saturday, December 7th. And we're learning about an expedition taken in 1820, comprised of 32 people, 8 mules, and 7 horses that traveled from Fort Atkinson in Nebraska to what is now Minneapolis. And two of the men on that journey kept detailed journals that can show us a lot about what the land was like at that time. Stephen Watts Kearney and Andrew Talcott were those men. And Glenn, as the naturalist part of this team, tell us a little bit about the route that this journey took and the land that they would encounter on that route.
Yes, they started out, crossed Fort Atkinson, crossed the Missouri River, which was quite a feat in itself. And their first campground was near Honey Creek, Iowa. And then they went around the Luss Hills through Pigeon Creek access, and they camped probably somewhere close to Hitchcock, is the best we can tell. And then they would have made campgrounds at what now BB Town or south of Logan, and then near Denison, well, Dunlap, excuse me, near Dunlap. And Larry will relate an interesting story about Dunlap a little bit later. Then they went up through Denison, up through Peterson, Cherokee, and then Spencer area, where they got lost. And it's an interesting story here. Their guide was a, we're pretty much sure, probably an Omaha Native American, and he got lost in that area because it was beyond his knowledge.
Okay.
And there's an interesting story that Watts writes about how the Native guide and his wife got in a terrible argument, and she broke down in tears because she knew that they were lost and they were afraid that they would meet some horrible fate because they misguided them. So,
it sounds like a modern road trip, yeah. Although the stakes were much, much higher back then.
Yes. Well, the thing that struck me is that Talcott was a really accomplished engineer. They navigated with sextants and dead reckoning and distance recognizing sun compasses, you know, the so-called primitive navigation. They did pretty well. And when he recorded the latitudes and we, from their descriptions of the area where they camped, they were pretty much dead on within a mile or so. So they were, and they carried with them two navigation books, McKay's Longitudes and then Nautical Almanac's, I can't pronounce it this morning, of 1820. It was a very complicated book, and Talcott was no nonsense guy, and Watts was very much the poetic gentleman in writing. You talk about turkeys. They saw turkeys in their route. They also bison, but the bison herds in Iowa were not as huge as they are in the West. They did see approximately 5,000 buffalo or bison near Ida Grove. Elk, deer, fishers, which most people, which is a in the mink family, badgers, sandhill cranes, and then they foraged off the land. They took a small amount of provisions with them, mostly whiskey and gunpowder and some dried pork, but the rest of the time they hunted and lived off the land. And Watts, Kearney also talked quite a bit about the weather. It in July.
Yeah, let's talk about when they set out, because they set out July 1st.
Yes.
And then they finished up on August 18th. So they basically did a rag-bri type weather for,
yes,
indeed, for 6
indeed.
Weeks.
Indeed, that would be the best way to describe it, yeah. The interesting thing about it is they got lost, but Talcott figured a shorter route back, and he had a direct route back. He was and did not... But yes, the weather was...
They didn't want to take that route again, for sure.
No. But they were out in the rainstorms, what did they have? They didn't have ponchos. They were stuck in the middle of these rainstorms. And mosquitoes they complained about. They had to deal with ticks and chiggers and all these things. And they survived.
Absolutely. Well, and Kearney writes in his journal about waking up in the morning and finding that his blanket was as wet as if it had been dunked in the river because of the heavy early morning dew. And I think anybody who goes for walks in the morning in Iowa is very familiar with how just in July and August, everything is wet all the time. They must have been soaked through even on the nice days, I would think.
Yeah, indeed. And it just amazes me the strength of these people. Well, one of the other comments that you were talking about, the route that we discovered, not the route, but the people who went along, there were four African-American slaves who came along. One was named Toby, the other one is named James. And so for our African-American friends that are listening, these guys had to work twice as hard. They had to take care of themselves, and they had to take care of their officers that supposedly owned them. So we got to give African-Americans a bit credit here, too, on this route.
That was quite the journey. And there were only 7 horses on this journey and 8 mules. So did anyone ride, or was this entirely done on foot and the animals were just for carrying their belongings?
Well, the officers rode. Everybody else walked.
Oh, that seems fair. Not.
Yeah. And that's how they measured distance, about how far could a man walk in a day in a period of time, and they would determine their distance they traveled by how many hours they marched. And of course, they were marching through tall grass, through ravines, through rivers, around lakes, so it was not easy. But one of the things that struck me was they were describing the upper Des Moines River and saying that they could see the bottom of the river. The water was totally clear. They could see down to the bottom of the river. And it just struck me about how things have changed so much. And we don't realize the ravines that we see in our modern drainage ditches and rivers weren't there. They were just shallow depressions with water running through them. They were not if you look at the current Buya River, which is kind of a ditch now, it wasn't like that. It was just a kind of a shallow depression. It was easy to cross.
Wow. Well, I'm sure a lot of things were not easy, because thinking about crossing the prairie, of course, the land as we know it today in Iowa has been largely drained. The prairies at that time, they were traveling through the prairie pothole region, so there would have been wetlands all over the place. When you look at Talcott's journal, Glenn, do you see that? Do you see them talking about getting mired in mud and walking through wet areas?
Oh, yeah, constantly wet areas, but they didn't see mud. There wasn't much of that at all. Most of the prairie was, they very seldom find disturbed areas in the native prairie.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But there's one little passage that I find that Watts was a beautiful writer. And can I read?
Yeah, please do.
I think it's kind of funny, and I figured out where this is at. This is just about 2 to 3 miles south of Denison, Iowa, on the Buya River. He says, "Crossed the ravine at 7 a.m. Our party was again on the march. Followed the river course a little east of north, and being in advance of the party, rode to the summit of the bluff on the right, and on a broken and barren spot, was attacked by a small swarm of small wasps with yellow wings and very small heads. Not being disposed to contest the point for the dominion of that tract of which they were the previous inhabitants, I made a rapid retreat, not, however, until I was severely stung by some of the most enraged. Crossed the Buya River at 1 p.m. I love his language.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Carney's descriptions in the journal. I mean, that was a wonderful description of encountering some bees, but what are some of the other things that he wrote about? He was not as focused on the land as Talcott was. What was he trying to convey with his writing?
Well, he's trying to convey the general nature of what the kind of land they were going through. And one of the more interesting things was that once they crossed the Buya River until they got to the Little Sioux River up by Peterson, Iowa, which is almost 60-mile stretch here, they found almost no wood. They didn't have enough to create a campfire, and it created some problems for when they were trying to cook their meat and this type of thing for their meals. Fortunately, they did have along a supply of salt pork, which was no problem at all for the soldiers, but for the Indian guide and his wife, they were not used to a diet of salted pork, and they became quite ill from it. until they were able to get to, like, the Little Sioux, and they were able to find some wood and get campfires going and be able to cook meat in the traditions, more traditions of what their guides had were familiar with.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that you bring that up because, of course, for so many of the explorers or the military or the settlers, whatever you want to call these individuals who were making their way west, they would carry with them cured meat because it was easy to carry. And when they got to Fort Snelling, they found that the troops that were stationed at Fort Snelling in Minnesota were suffering from scurvy because all they ate was meat, right?
Yes, that was a problem. They didn't have the vegetables and vitamins necessary to avoid that. Although in Fort Snelling, they did, once they realized what was happening, they did have an extensive garden system set up, and they also went to a better water supply, and their health conditions improved, but at the beginning, they did have problems there.
And I know, Larry, you've picked out something to read to us from Kearney's journal as well. Can you share the passage that you chose?
Well, the passage that I was thinking about was not necessarily from Kearney. It was about Kearney.
Okay.
Because one of the historians that spent a fair amount of time talking about Kearney and his journeys was William J. Peterson, who was for many years the superintendent of the Iowa State Historical Society and wrote a four-volume history on Iowa called The Story of Iowa, a Progress of an American State. He published it in 1952, but about Kearney, this is what he said. Probably no military man or civilian saw so much of what was now Iowa and described what he saw so very well as did Stephen Watt Kearney's between 1820 and 1835. During those years, he made long expeditions into the heart of Iowa land and observed carefully the topography of the country, the various kinds of plants, animals, and the various Indians that he encountered. So I thought that was a very fine tribute to Kearney by someone who is very well knowledgeable in his activities and efforts.
You have both spent a lot of time with this journal and then, of course, the recently released journal of Andrew Talcott as well. Larry, what do you think is important about this history? What do you want the people that come to your presentation or the people that are listening now to take away from what you've learned?
Well, I think this is one of the very earliest items in history that in this part of the state. It explains what was happening and what a lot of things that how things looked here at that time, because I think, as you mentioned, Iowa is probably has the most disturbed landscape of any place in the world. Something like 99.9% of our prairie has disappeared, and this is a description of kind of what it was like back then. And they did, both of these men did do a detailed amount of work on it. The 1820 trip out from Fort Atkinson to Fort Snelling lasted about 24 days, and they covered 395 miles during that time.
Wow.
But they found a better route back because on the way back, they only covered 18 days, and some of those were days when they didn't travel very far. And their whole distance was 257 miles.
And how did they come back? What was that route?
They came started at Fort Snelling and came down the Minnesota River as far as they could, and then came into Iowa and tried to find their route that they had taken up on the western part of the state, where the Indian guide had been very accurate in where he had led them, and followed that back down to Fort Atkinson.
All right, so that was did that become a route that was commonly used? I'm struck that the journey that they took was so difficult that maybe it just wasn't a common journey to take.
Well, as it turned out, their evaluation was that there was no good route between Fort Atkinson and Fort Snelling. There was long areas where there was no woods. There was areas where the water was a little hard to find. There's other areas where there was way too much water, where there was swamps and lakes and stuff that were hard to get through. When they got in the eastern part, there were some very high hills and rough land that they had to go through. And their general conclusion was there really wasn't a good route. And as it turned out, it wasn't necessary because The times kind of caught up with them, because by the time they had their evaluations in and all this sort of thing, the interest in the West was also moving farther west. Fort Atkinson in Nebraska lasted only a few years. It was built in 1819 to 1920, and by 1927 it was abandoned. And there were other forts farther west and in different areas that they, the Army felt was more important. And as a result, whether there was a road through from Fort Atkinson to Fort Snelling was not necessarily so important anymore.
All right. Well, it's still kind of a difficult drive to make. But
oh, yes, yes.
We are.
And you consider that most of these people were on foot.
Right.
And you can imagine walking from Omaha to Minneapolis.
Right. In the middle of summer.
In the middle of summer.
Larry Grill, thank you so much.
And okay, thank you.
Glenn Pollack, thank you.
Thank you. There's much more we could talk about.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Thank you guys for sharing your knowledge with us today. Larry Grill and Glenn Pollack will be giving a presentation together called Chronicles from the Trail at Hitchcock Nature Center in Pottawatomie County on Saturday, December 7th, sharing some of what they've learned from the journals of Stephen Watts Kearney and Andrew Talcott, writing about an expedition they took in the summer of 1820. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Turkeys make appearances on dining room tables this time of year, of course, but it's also a great time of year to see wild turkeys in Iowa. Like so many of the wild creatures in our state, these once plentiful creatures were hunted out of existence. But also, like so many other wild creatures in Iowa, they have an amazing comeback story. To help us learn more about these fascinating, odd, and beautiful birds, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Adam Jenke is here. Adam, welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And let's talk about this story. With so many wild creatures in Iowa, it's the story that we tell. So when settlers moved into Iowa, there were lots of wild turkeys here. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. So we think that wild turkeys would have been pretty common in Iowa at the time of European settlement. And we know that settler accounts reflect that. And that's the reason we have places like the Turkey River in northeastern Iowa. So they would have been found along our rivers where we would have had a lot of trees and then, you know, adjacent prairies and ag settlements. But by the mid-1800s, two things had played out in Iowa that led to the demise of the wild turkey here. One was what we call unregulated exploitation. That's an important distinction between modern hunting, where we have strict science-based regulations, but we had unregulated take, and that led to real reductions in the number of turkeys and the prospects of turkeys surviving. And then the other important factor is that we cleared almost all of that forest habitat as we found it at the time of European settlement. So a story common for many of our native wildlife, they were once abundant, and then because of habitat destruction and this irresponsible, unregulated take, we basically entirely lost wild turkeys from Iowa.
All right, well, let's talk about that comeback story.
Yeah.
When were wild turkeys reintroduced?
Yeah, so efforts to reintroduce wild turkeys were kind of fits and starts throughout the 1900s, but the 1960s is where we really kind of made the progress on that. We made it a priority to follow the model for white-tailed deer. Remember, white-tailed deer followed a similar fate. And by the 1960s, our work there was functionally done. White-tailed deer were back. And so the Iowa Conservation Commission then shifted to focus on wild turkey restoration. And by the late 1960s, they had some successes. And those successes were in big chunks of forest habitat, Shimmick State Forest in southeastern Iowa, and also Yellow River State Forest in northeastern Iowa. And so by the early 70s, wild turkeys that had been introduced from primarily Missouri, but also states as far away as Texas, were starting to do well in these big forested environments in eastern Iowa.
Well, and let's talk about the kind of habitat that wild turkeys like, because you certainly do encounter them in forests, yep. but these days we encounter them in other places as well.
And that's a perfect transition, actually. So the wildlife biologists at the time, they thought it would take 10,000 acres of continuous forest to have a wild turkey. They were basing that off of where wild turkeys had persisted in the Midwest, and that was in places like southern Missouri, where there were big continuous tracts of forest. And so that's why we started in places like Yellow River and Shimmick, places in Stevens, places where we had a lot of continuous forest. That, of course, we learned was not the case. Wild turkeys are quite adaptable, and we find wild turkeys in every county in Iowa today, and they can occupy areas with just a few scattered trees normally associated with rivers and streams around the state. So they do, because of their behavior, they roost in trees. So trees are required, but it is not the 10,000 acre big continuous forest tracts that wildlife biologists in the 70s thought that we needed.
Thinking about my childhood, I was born in 1975. I spent a lot of time outside as a child, and I actually specifically remember the very first time I ever saw a wild turkey. It must have been in the early 80s, and my family was visiting Fraser, Iowa, to see where my grandmother had grown up, and there was a forested area, and we saw probably 15 turkeys, and it was such a thrill.
Sure.
But, you know, what a... Just thinking about that compared to now, there are so many turkeys. I see turkeys all the time.
That's right. Yeah. Especially in eastern Iowa and areas where there's a lot of wooded cover, the turkey has been really adaptable. And they've made it work in environments that we never would have imagined that they would make it work, where they have trees. They eat, historically, they would have eaten a lot of acorns and other seeds and nuts. Today, they continue to eat acorns and seeds and nuts that are common in Iowa's forest. But of course, we also know they take advantage of that important food source for wildlife, corn. And with 13 million acres of that grown across Iowa every year, there's plenty of spare food for wild turkeys to eat during the wintertime and survive on.
Well, I still get a thrill every time I see them, even though they're pretty common now.
Yep.
But the fact that wild turkeys were successfully introduced into Iowa, that also set the stage for another successful reintroduction in Iowa. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, this is a fun one. So we were successful with restoring white-tailed deer, and then we started with turkeys, and we were successful with wild turkeys. And so then we started with the river otter. Now, how is the river otter and the wild turkey connected? That's an interesting story. So Iowa had some rules against purchasing wildlife for translocations or reintroductions. And so we relied on trading with neighboring states that had other species of wildlife. And that was the case in the 80s when we wanted to start to reintroduce the river otter. And so our wild turkeys were doing well. We had a hunting season and they were quite abundant. And Kentucky said that they wanted some of our wild turkeys to introduce in their restoration efforts there. And Kentucky had the ability to buy river otters from Louisiana. So river otters in Louisiana were purchased by Kentucky. We traded our wild turkeys with Kentucky for their river otters, and then reintroduce those river otters into our rivers and streams. And today we've documented river otters in every county in the state.
Wow. And we didn't have the ability to just buy those river otters from Louisiana? That wouldn't have worked?
Yeah, there's some curious rules about that I don't know the whole backstory from, but that was the case. We were not able to make the transaction with Louisiana directly. And so we had to figure out a way to get what we wanted and partner with another state agency that has, of course, the regulatory authority over resident wildlife like this, to get what we needed to be able to restore river otters. And so that was some pretty creative thinking, I think, by our wildlife biologists at the time, to figure out a way to take something that a conservation success story that we had and use that to build momentum for the next conservation success story, the river otter restoration in Iowa.
Well, that's very cool. Now, let's talk more about turkeys, because again, when you drive along the interstates, it's not uncommon to see a whole flock of turkeys out in a field or near a wooded area. But let's talk about these birds, because they are such big, beautiful, and unusual birds. And I want to start with flight, because you mentioned that they roost in trees, but my memory of those very first turkeys that I ever saw was of them trying to get airborne.
Yes.
And it seemed like they needed a really long runway. Right. So tell me about their flight.
It's a laborious affair if you've ever been around for it. It's actually sort of humorous to watch. So as you observed, they have to run to take off. That's a big bird. Now, this is not as big as the bird that's going to be on people's tables for Thanksgiving, but it's a big bird. And so it takes a lot to get that bird into the air. And they're also a bird that's mostly adapted for short distance flights. And then they spend most of their time running around. So when they do fly, they get a running start and take off, and then can fly up into the top of trees. And then I don't know if you've ever been in the woods, Charity, to see them fly down, but it's really quite a sight. They'll chatter in the morning back and forth to one another as they wake up. And then eventually one will decide to jump out of the canopy of the trees, and they generally glide down to where they like to land, an open spot, a crop field, or an open area in the woods, glide down, and then they'll spend their whole day, unless they're harassed by a predator, they'll spend their whole day on the ground before going back up at sunset.
Do they always flock together?
They are very gregarious. And so to answer that question, we have to talk about just sort of the life cycle of the turkey, or the annual cycle of the mm-hmm. turkey. And so this time of year, you'll see them flocked. And they're flocked in multiple sexes and multiple different ages. The males and females are together, and the young are there as well. And they'll be in large flocks this time of year. All basically moving around together, roosting together, and finding their food sources together, feeding together. And they of course feed on the ground. So they're scratching up vegetation. And so being in a flock is advantageous for both avoiding predators and also feeding. Now during the springtime, that's when they are a little less social, because, they have of course a different thing on their mind, and that's reproduction. And so during this time of year, the males will get very territorial, and the males will basically start to spend their time more or less alone. If it were up to them, they would be completely alone, surrounded
only
by females.
Male
that's
around, right.
But that's what leads to the controversies. And so that time of year, the females respond to the males. The males do displays.
Yeah, that's let's break that down a little bit, because that's one of the things that makes turkeys really special. And I think a lot of us, of course, have small children bringing home pictures of turkeys this time of year, inspired by breeding displays. So tell me what the tom turkeys do to attract those females.
Yeah, so this is a really neat time of year. So this, you know, as their hormones change and the seasons change, the males drive to be alone and start to attract their mates. And so they will gobble. That's the familiar sound. But if you haven't ever heard it in the wild, it's really something remarkable to hear on a still morning, the gobble of a wild turkey, or in many cases in parts of Iowa, gobbles of turkeys all over the countryside at daybreak. And so they will gobble, and then they'll get down to the ground and continue to gobble and display. And that activity attracts the attention of females that are looking to breed. And the females come in and do what many females of birds do. They observe from a distance and take into consideration their potential mates. Many times you'll see a couple of males doing what we call strutting, when they erect all their feathers on their body, including that big, beautiful fan, and they'll display that to the female. The color of the male's head will pulse with reds and blues and whites.
Right. I mean, their skin actually changes color.
That's right. Yep. All part of their courtship display. So they'll turn to this bright red color because there's so much blood circulating around the head. They have this structures on their face called wattles that will change color and appearance to attract mates. And then if the female is receptive, they will breed. And the female lays a clutch of eggs that time of year. And eventually this breeding behavior subsides, and the males are done for the year. So the males form groups, and they're social again. They get along
better during the summer.
Fine, that's right. And then the females go off to raise their young, and they do that alone. And then once they hatch a brood, they'll raise that. And so they'll be in a social group.
Where do the females nest?
They nest on the forest floor. They will, and sometimes in some like kind of grassy or shrubby habitats, they'll build these nests, of course, right on the ground, and they're pretty big nests. And then they will incubate them for about 30 days. And then the chicks hatch, and the wild turkey is a class of birds or young that we call precocial, meaning that they can feed on their own right away. And so they leave the nest.
Like baby chicks.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. To contrast with like robins, that where the adults physically feed the young. The wild turkeys will teach their young how to feed, but the young feed on their own on insects for the first couple weeks of their life.
All right. And then, of course, you, if you're lucky, you get to see the mother with this whole line of chicks following her as she teaches them how to go about the world.
Yeah, it's really cool. And the other interesting thing about turkeys is they learn to fly pretty early. So you'll see very small turkeys capable of flight. It contrasts that with, like, you know, a Canada goose that's basically full grown before it learns how to fly.
Do they fly better when they're young, when
that's
they're lighter?
That's a funny question. I don't know for sure scientifically, but it does seem a little less labored for a small bird. I think maybe their best days are their young ones when they're a little more maneuverable before they get those big bodies and they try to go crashing through the trees.
Now, of course, humans are predators of turkeys. Yep. What are the other predators?
So when they're young, a lot of things. Of course, eggs, everything will eat an egg. I always say nothing says no to an egg. So raccoons, skunk, snakes, squirrels, all sorts of things will eat. Crows and other things will all eat those. When they're small and young, we could see some predation by birds, but eventually turkeys get big enough that birds probably aren't a big mortality source. And so then it's just basically bobcat, foxes, and coyotes. That would be the predators for adult or full-grown turkeys throughout the year.
I've heard that if turkeys get disturbed from their nest, that sometimes that can mean that they won't go back to the nest. Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah, that's common in a lot of our ground nesting birds, that they have sort of evolved that tendency to abandon nests. Now, that varies, of course, with investment. So if that hen had just laid maybe one egg or two or three eggs and she got disturbed off of the nest, it's quite likely that she would abandon the nest and not come back and start a new one somewhere else. But if she's been on that nest for 20 days or so, laid a complete clutch and been incubating, it's less likely that she would abandon.
You mentioned the hunting season. Of course, these are animals that are hunted mm-hmm. in Iowa. What is the season?
Yeah, so there's two turkey hunting seasons. The classic turkey hunting season that we think about is during that spring breeding season, where hunters are pursuing the males, the gobbling males, and trying to attract them and take advantage of that territorial behavior, that breeding behavior, and call them in and harvest the males. During the fall, we also have a turkey hunting season that has less participation, but you can hunt turkeys similar to ways you would hunt deer, kind of waiting for them to walk by. Or some people will go out and actually try to call in whole flocks of turkeys for hunting. And during that time of year, we can shoot both females and males, the small quota.
For people who aren't interested in hunting but are interested in seeing turkeys, do you have some advice?
Yeah, so you can look for turkeys year-round. You can look for them in open areas. Of course, is the most common way and place to see them. If you sit idly by in the woods and listen in the morning in an area you know there to be turkeys, it can be really neat, like I said, to see them fly out of a tree. I was actually deer hunting last year, and turkeys were roosting in the trees right adjacent to me, and eventually the whole show came to the tree that I was in, and it was really remarkable.
Nice.
To watch. And so you can see them in the woods. And then the other thing I would think about is if you go to a park or a state park or county conservation area or something, when there's snow on the ground, look for those tracks in the snow. That'll tell you where a flock has been or may be going, and you could maybe observe them.
Adam Janke, thank you so much.
Yes, it was my pleasure.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Iowa State University Extension wildlife specialist Adam Janke.